Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 67 of Season 5 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is John from the Dirty Harry Minutes. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you, Rob. I'm really grateful I can join you. I couldn't join you for When Harry Met Sally because, you know, I do Dirty Harry Minute podcast, and it was too triggering for me. I thought maybe it was some sort of fan fiction about Dirty Harry getting a wife, so I had to sit that one out.
You know, I never even thought about that. That's interesting. That's very interesting. And who do you think Sally would be then if it's fan fiction? Any guess? The only Sally that comes to mind is Sally Kellerman. I don't know why. I can't think of the other.
She's in MASH, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. The unfortunate universe of Dirty Harry is his wife died in a motor car accident, so it's very sad. Maybe her name was Sally. Actually, I think in the novelization her name was Denise. But yeah,
maybe they got that wrong.
The least
maybe it should have been Sally. You know, that would have been very funny if they chose those names because of Dirty Harry. That would have been great. Yeah. So
the big universe.
So I'm glad that you're able to come to this movie and discuss it with me without, having any preconceived notions about it being fan fiction. You know, again, this could be John McClane fan fiction. You know, it could be that this is connected to the Sixth Sense, where the character there is having a dream sequence that he's. That he's John McClane. It goes back to the whole, fan theory that Indiana Jones is basically a dream that Han Solo has when he's in frozen in carbonite. So I don't know. Could be.
This could be a last minute sort of occurrence on our street. Like Gruber is thinking this, Hans Gruber, when he's falling down slowly, this other scenario flashes through his head before he meets the ground.
It could be.
Maybe.
Yeah. Actually, I would think if that was the case, then I think that Die Hard with a Vengeance would be more what Hans Gruber would be thinking of, because he would try to find a way to enact revenge on John McClane. Yes. Yeah, so when we get there in a few seasons from now, you and I will try to remember that and bring that up again. Yeah, that makes sense. So minute 67 begins with the DOJ guy finishing his sentence and ends with Barnes giving a warning. So yesterday we ended things with John trying to get into an elevator, but a hand is held up by the DOJ guy, and he basically says to him, "No civilians." And we get the last syllable of that sentence today. And, apparently the DOJ guy doesn't want John involved, even though John's the only one who really has been helpful this entire time. But, I guess it's bureaucracy. We don't want no John McClane.
No homers.
And then John looks over and is trying to get some help, maybe from Trudeau. And Trudeau, has a look on his face that he, is sympathetic to what John's going through, and he wants to help him, but he does not believe that he can. And then as the elevator doors close, once again, John is alone, which I think is great because, John McClane works much better on his own. As much as you want to say that he's a team player, if you look in any of the movies, past or present, from what we're talking about right now, John McClane is always at his best when he is alone against the bad guy or against the situation. And,
exactly.
And that's one of the reasons why we love him.
Cannon.
Yeah,
precisely. Right. I know this through, through Dirty Harry. Can't really have the partner that lasts more than one movie. And, yeah, he's just got to be that loose cannon fighting the system and finding his unique solutions to problems. The answers seem pretty clear to him, but no one else can see that there are simple solutions.
That's right. It's the McClane solutions, I guess you can say.
Yes.
Because he knows how to do it, and they know how to write for the character well enough that, you know, in at least the all, you know, the first three movies in the trilogy, you know, we can definitely sympathize with John McClane with everything that he needs to do and how he's doing it and stuff like that. So yeah, I like it. I like the way that they do this. So once again, he's on his own. And then we linger on him for a few seconds. It's great that we can actually also see his shadow or reflection in the door of the elevator as it's closed also. You know, and there's like a little golden hue around it. So maybe it's, you know, maybe they're trying to show that he's somewhat an angelic figure or something like that. I don't know if that's on purpose or not. It just looks that way. And then the shot changes and we once again see the NEA plane flying, you know, in the sky. And there's silence for a few seconds and then we hear, "What the fuck?" And then we see that it's the navigator. Okay, the navigator on the NEA flight is played actually by a very famous actor. An actor by the name of Tom Everett. Have you ever heard of him before or seen him in anything before?
No. I'm drawing a blank. Tell me.
Okay, so he's been in he has 123 credits on IMDb.
Wow.
Okay, I'm trying to think of which ones, you know, which of his credits are things that are recognizable. But I mean, he goes all the way back to 1977. You know, his first role was in The Goodbye Girl. And then he was on a whole bunch of TV shows during the course of the 80s. He was in Beverly Hills Cop in 1984. He played, you know, a thief in that movie. You know, most of these roles that he's had over his career are small roles. We're not talking about big roles, but still, you know. And then, you know, here in this movie, he plays the navigator. He was on two episodes of Quantum Leap. He was in Dances with Wolves. He had a role as a sergeant named Sergeant Pepper. What other things has he been in that people might know him from? He was in Air Force One. He played the NSA advisor Jack Doherty.
Oh, okay.
Who I believe was one of the guys that was shot. You know, when they were killing people one by one, I think they killed him, if I remember correctly. He was in the movie 13 Days, which is a big favorite of mine, all about the Cuban Missile Crisis. He played Walter Sheridan in that movie. He was in
Pearl Harbor. That's the one with Costner in it?
Yes.
So the one with Costner? Yeah, yeah.
Yes. That's not bad. He was in Pearl Harbor. He played a presidential aide in 2001.
Ugh. Yuck.
The movie does have its moments. I wouldn't say it's completely horrendous. It does, you know, it's far from perfect. But you know, he was also in the movie Transformers. He played the National Deputy Director of Operations. He was in the curious case of Benjamin Button. He actually paid Benjamin for part of the movie. There was a TV show that I really enjoyed him in 2007 called Journeyman. Journeyman. Which was like a time travel type of thing, show. But a journalist who travels to the past and, you know, is able to alter people's lives and stuff like that. It was with Kevin McKidd. It only had 13 episodes, but I really enjoyed it. I think it was a really fun idea. And he played some top secret person there. You know, so yeah, he's had some nice parts over the course of his career. In this movie, he doesn't have much to say except for "what the f***." And I think later on, he maybe has one other line or something like that. And then the co-pilot responds and says, "What is it?" And the co-pilot's name is Stephen Smith Pershing, or Steve Pershing, who was born in 1949. So he was 30 when this movie came out. Oh, wait, he was 30. No, he was 40. Sorry, he was 40 when this movie came out. He doesn't really have very many IMDb credits. He only has 10 IMDb credits. This was the second to last one that he had. I don't know if he's still alive or not. IMDb is not updated about that. Hopefully he still is because he's only 70. So he's 73 at this point. And then the navigator says, "The outer marker beeper. It isn't beeping. It's talking. And then we see that he, flips the switch. And first of all, this is an explanation dump for us. You know, he's doing a good job of explaining to us the difference. I mean, beforehand, Barnes said what he's going to do. But here we're actually hearing it happen, where instead of it just beeping, you know, it's now you can actually hear someone talking. And then he flips the switch and everyone can now hear both us and the pilot and co-pilot. And then we get a speech from Barnes where he goes, "Attention all aircraft in Dulles landing pattern. This is Chief Engineer Leslie Barnes. I've been authorized to brief you in full. At this time, this is the only channel available to us. Here's the situation. Approximately 2 hours ago." So first of all, I like that we actually find out who he is. You know, his name is Leslie Barnes. Are you familiar with the name Leslie?
Yeah, it's a very common name here for, you know, people of our grandparents' generation. Les, obviously, the abbreviation. Is there a patron saint? Is there a Saint Leslie? I doubt it.
No.
Nope.
Not that
What's
I'm aware.
What's its origin?
Okay. First of all, it's a gender neutral name, meaning it could be for either male or female, mm-hmm. and it's a Scottish origin that means holly garden, which is an evergreen plant with bright red berries that grows all over Scotland. It also refers to there is a castle in Scotland, a medieval castle known as Castle Leslie, which is in Aberdeenshire. You know, so that's more or less what Leslie means. It can be spelled numerous ways. It could be Leslie, Lesley. Its variants also are like Laszlo and Leslie. There's like a whole bunch of different things. I mean, I found like a really, really long list of people named Leslie. But there isn't anybody who like jumped out at me that this is a person that you know, because it's both a male name, a female name, or it could also be a surname. So, you know, I have the only one that really jumped out at me is Leslie Nielsen, who we mentioned yesterday. Or maybe we mentioned – wait, did we mention it yesterday or we mentioned it – or did we mention it before or was that in the green yesterday. Room?
I mentioned it yesterday about airplane. You must be resisting every guest making an airplane pun. Like even before when the co-pilot said, "Why? What is it?" After the guy said, "What the beep?"
Yeah.
But well, it's the act of co-mating with another member of the other sex, but that's not important right now.
That's right.
Surely every guest has been making these jokes. So yeah, Leslie, there you go.
That's true. Did you know that Bob Hope's real name was Leslie?
No.
His name was Leslie Bob Hope.
Oh, I do know he was born in England, wasn't he? Like Cary Grant, but
yes, he was born in England. Yes, he was born in England. Leslie Howard, another British actor. Leslie Jordan, who just passed away a few months ago. You know, he was a comedic actor.
Maybe the name Leslie was chosen on purpose. Oh yeah, you mentioned Leslie Howard. He was shot down in a plane too, I think.
Yes,
in World War
Yes,
II.
We
yeah.
talked about that. We talked about that, I think it was in week three, when I think it was when Niall was on. I'm pretty sure we talked about that when he was on.
Yeah. Interesting. Such a sad story, isn't it?
Yes.
I think maybe there was a spy connection. Maybe he was also...
Yes. They thought there's suspicions. There's a conspiracy theory that he was a spy, and that's why they did it. You have an actress named Leslie Ann Warren, who was very famous in the 80s in a lot of different movies. She was in Clue.
Yeah.
She was
another airplane connection. Yeah, she was in Hanover Street with Harrison Ford, obviously played a pilot. Yeah, so there you go. It all comes back to aviation, man.
Yeah, completely. So we find out that his first name is Leslie, and now we know why everyone calls him Barnes. and then the shot changes, but we're still, you know, in the same time frame, and we're back on the plane, and we see Victor and Thornburg walking to the galley, and you saw a stewardess just leave the galley at the same time that they get there, and then Victor says, wait till you get a load of this, and then you know, he gives Thornburg, you know, an earpiece for him to listen in on. And we continue to hear what Barnes says. And he says, do not accept any instructions claiming to be from our tower unless you hear your own flight recorder access code. The terrorists have got all our systems. And
yeah,
this is something that I never paid attention to, you know, what he's actually saying when Thornburg is listening, because, you know, it's we hear it very, the tone is very low where we can hear it. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense, but if the bad guys have taken over controls of everything and they know what flights are on, I mean, they have all those little plastic sheets of each of the flights. They wouldn't have the flight recorder access code of each of the planes. Or is this more for them to say, okay, this is going to be our code? So even though Stewart and his men know the code of using, you know, of they know the access code, but if they, you know, but they don't know that when they're speaking to the plane, they should say, okay, NEA flight X access code 1234, you know, it's us in the tower. Maybe that's what it comes down to. It's like, you know, a code phrase to be using. Could you think that could be what it is?
I'm inclined to agree with you, but even going back to first principles, like the pilots must be so confused. Like perhaps this, maybe they know Barnes's voice. No, they wouldn't. But perhaps his message is the terrorist speaking.
That could be awesome.
So even if they did get the right code, yeah. I'd as a pilot, I wouldn't necessarily be agreeing with or like believing everything Barnes is saying to begin with anyway.
Well, maybe the people in the plane know that only someone like Barnes would be able to tap into the auto marker beeper and instead of making it beep talk.
Yeah, no, that's true. You could rationalize it that way. I'm sure this conversation is happening in the cockpit now between the pilot and the navigator. Yeah.
That's right. But then, you're right. They do take it too quickly at face value and believe everything that's being said. You know, maybe that has to do with the fact that this takes place in a pre-9/11 world, meaning that if it were to be taking place now, then there would be much more suspicion.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? Surely most of the planes have seen the other plane crash?
Well, we talked about this a little bit last week. There's a lot of fog, and they're very high up, so maybe they didn't see it. You know, I mean, the fact is that when the planes at the end of the movie get closer, then they're able to see the flames from the other plane that's going to explode. So, I mean, I think that's a good enough explanation that from the height that they're flying, they actually cannot see the plane.
Yeah.
The debris and the fire and stuff like that. Yeah. With cloud cover or anything like that. I mean, first of all, it's a good thing that Victor actually was paying attention, you know, that he was listening to this beeping sound, which I'm assuming we talked about this, you know, earlier. It must be really annoying for someone to have to constantly be listening to a beeping sound, you know, and that's what Victor was doing. You know, he might have wanted to listen to he was listening to his headphones beforehand. So, you know, he was possibly listening to some good, you know, 80s or 90s music at the time, you know, and then Thornburg bugs him and tells him that he wants to start listening to this beeping sound that is just constantly beeping every 5 seconds, 10 seconds, whatever it is. You know, so I don't know. But
there's a
know,
bit
it,
of
it still works.
Yeah. One thing I noticed on replaying this, there's a bit of movie time logic. Like Thornburg just listens to it for like 3 seconds before currently like getting up to speed of what's going on. Like even before you hear the word terrorist, yeah. So that's a bit of movie time logic there, which always makes me laugh. Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, as soon as he hears the word terrorist, and then he turns to Victor and says, holy shit, get this on tape. And, you know, I love how Victor already has the tape out. He's already, you remember beforehand, he pulled up a very large radio to be listening to here. And now he just has what looks like a Walkman. You know, where's that big radio that he pulled out last week?
Yeah, exactly. Sir, you're gonna have to stow that above your head.
That's right. No, but again, he's now listening on a Walkman and is able to record it. And then we continue to hear Barnes say, and now have control of everything except this channel. So it goes back to, okay, they know everything about they control everything in the airport, but the one thing they can't control is the outer marker beacon. That's what it is. And then the stewardess tries to push them away and get them out of the galley. And Thornburg says, give us a second here, please. At least he's being polite. You got to give him credit for that because he's usually not. And then Barnes continues again. This channel is secure, but your own transmissions are not. Do not repeat. Do not. And then he gets cut off with what he's trying to say. It's very interesting that, it goes back to what you said before. How do the pilots know that this is authentic? And the fact that Barnes is telling them, don't acknowledge just because then the other will say it. So it can work the other way too. Think about it. If it was Stewart who was doing this and he was the one sending out, giving this information to the pilots, and then he were to say, if you hear from anybody else, just ignore them because, I'm the real person. Just mind-boggling thinking about the whole thing. Because it could go
could go either way. It makes me think the aviation authority probably has a contingency for this, like pilots having really unique passwords or something that only they know before a flight or something direct from the tower. You'd like to think there's some sort of system.
But each tower, you have thousands of towers around the country. You want to try and keep something like that secret, you can't say, to everyone, okay, my code name is Batman. And everyone knows that when John is flying, then the code is Batman. And when Niall is flying, then the code is Superman. No offense, Niall. And I should have thought that one through a little further, a little earlier, and use the Batman for him. But whatever. Just as the example, I think it would have worked that way. So I don't know.
Yeah. Still, I'd like to think there's some sort of. Anyway, the fact that I can't think of the top of my head doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but some other level of protection to what a pilot should do if he receives a message that he thinks is suspicious or how to confirm it. Anyway.
I think that is what they tried doing in on 9/11. The fact that they sent messages to to all the planes telling them that there have been cockpit breaches. And if you've ever seen the movie United 93, which is a favorite of mine, it's very difficult to watch, but I still watch it over and over because it's so powerful. And the pilot and co-pilot pretty much scoff at the idea, that it's possible that there's a hijack and that you should be careful not to let anybody into the cockpit, And now post 9/11, people look at that and think of it very differently.
Yeah.
So yeah. And then basically the minute ends as Thornburg is motioning to Victor for something. Like maybe he's asking for a pen or paper. Or something.
Bag of peanuts. Chris already got one.
Could be. No, that will get. We'll talk about that tomorrow. The bag of peanuts. All right. So you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
I think in one of the earlier minutes, the air stewardess really puts him in his place, doesn't he? Doesn't she? And mentions how that article about bimbos in the sky or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they're a bit more assertive. But I suppose here he's polite enough, so she just goes away. That was one of my notes. Where's the confident and sassy and assertive stewardess that we saw a few minutes ago? That's no big thing. And also notice there's a can of V8 juice in one of the earlier seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know. Well, growing up, that was like a real exotic drink when it was on the first on the market here in Australia.
Well, I remember they had commercials about V8s.
Ah, was that the beast? Was that really exotic when it came out in the late 80s or whatever? Because in Australia,
I believe it was.
Yeah. And it just got me thinking how these movies were magical as a young kid. Like, there's so many American products that we'd only see on films or on TV shows, like in the Goonies, you got Domino's pizza that he has. You know what I mean? It's all like this exotic stuff. Like, wow! And so you'd see a movie like this, and you see, wow, but you can make a phone call on an American plane. And I mean, maybe you could have done that on an Australian plane. I don't know, but like. Just the exotic world of pop culture that these sort of movies explain. So I thought, oh, V8, you know, that's something I'd see in a movie. And anyway, I don't know where I'm really going with this point, Rob, but I'm saying that some things you might see like it's just a wrapper, a candy bar or a Palomar or whatever. But yeah, it's quite exotic.
That's why we talk about these things, you know, and, you know, I'm glad you brought it up. So a V8 is a juice that was made from 8 different vegetables, a mixture of vegetables and fruits. And they started making them in 1948. It's owned by the Campbell Soup Company.
Oh.
And so it's known as a V8 because of the fact that it has 8 different vegetables that are being used in it. The vegetables are beet, celery, carrots, lettuce, parsley, watercress, spinach, and tomato. They've obviously made a whole bunch of different variations of that over the years, so it's not exactly the same thing. I mentioned before about the fact that I remember the commercials. So the slogan for V8 in the 70s was, should have had a V8. You know, it was if I remember correctly, it was like they'd have commercials with people who don't have enough strength to do something, and therefore, you know, they, you know, I'm trying to remember like what they had to do, but the idea was is that they needed to do something and they say, oh, too bad. I could have had a V8 and it would have given me more strength to do what I wanted to do. You know, that type of thing.
Well, I hope John McClane's had one. He's going to need one next few minutes, next half hour.
Yeah, that's true. It would help him, but I don't think he's going to be able to get the one on the plane.
Burned up on impact. Yeah.
Well, no, not yet. But you know, no, but it's on this plane that hasn't crashed yet.
We'll see. You know, we'll see.
It's running out of fuel. It's slowly running out of fuel, but we'll have
less
to see.
Less than 2 hours. There.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. So basically, the script is pretty much word for word. You know, the one thing it tells us that Victor has everything on a micro cassette recorder. And that's it. You know, everything that they basically say is word for word here. So there are no differences in the script. Yeah. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Disaster Tuesday, where, you know, we talk a little bit about some sort of aircraft disaster that happened. And what I try and do is try and find something that's somehow closely related to my guest. You know, so I was trying to try and find something that would fit for you, John. And have you ever heard of someone by the name of Byron Kennedy?
Yes, the producer of Mad Max. It was George Miller's buddy, and he died in a plane, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He was 33 years old, and it happened on the 17th of July, 1983. All right, he actually, at the age of 18, formed his own production company and produced a whole bunch of amateur short films, you know, in a short period of time. In 1970, he won the Kodak Trophy, which is Australia's top best on 8 for the short film Hobson's Bay, which was a documentary about the Melbourne port, the Melbourne suburb of Williamstown. And by getting money for this, he was able to start, you know, traveling around the world and doing other things. He met George Miller in university in 1969. They were in the University of Melbourne together. They made a film together called Violence in the Violence in the Cinema, which won international acclaim. And they created a company called Kennedy Miller, which they incorporated in 1975, with the two of them as co-directors. Their first major movie together was what you mentioned earlier, Mad Max, which came out in 1979. And the film set a record for the highest grossing film relative to the budget. That it took 20 years for another movie to break that record, and that was the Blair Witch Project that did it in 1999. Oh. He also produced Mad Max 2, which grossed over $100 million worldwide in 1981. In 1983, when he was only 33 years old, he was killed at the Warragamba Dam in New South Wales, where the helicopter that he was piloting actually crashed. Now, what happened is that he was flying 10 feet above the ground, and he hit the water with the rear of the skids when he was attempting to climb. And therefore, the helicopter lost traction and, I guess, crashed because of that. And so, obviously, it's known as a pilot error. You know, it's not something. There was apparently nothing faulty with the helicopter itself, but he himself was. I wonder if he was there trying to, you know, scope out like a you know, location or something like that. You know, flying, because he's flying over around a dam. You know, in a helicopter, and yeah. You don't normally fly that close to the ground, or maybe he was just going for a little. You know, quiet time away from other people.
Yeah, and that's a sad story. So young. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. I'm glad you actually knew who he was, and we've all learned a little bit more about who Byron Kennedy was. All right, so John, you want to once again tell people where they can find you?
DirtyHarryMinute.com website has all the links to, you know, the podcast and how to contact us. Yeah.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, mother chucker.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here